There's something that we can learn from the parshas that we're reading now, which is a very important message and something that's very heavy. We'll dedicate this shiur this evening to people who are suffering. And that is something that we can learn about the nature of suffering and how one's supposed to handle it and the concept of happiness. Simcha. So there's, you see, from the teachings of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, you see an opportunity to learn a remarkable thing. I'll reconstruct slightly what he says, but the idea is something like this. You see, there's a remarkable problem that presents itself if you read the Chumash and you see the Chazal's comments about certain angles that perhaps don't present themselves on the surface. You see something remarkable. He points out the following observation. You have an interchange of words between Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, and Paro, the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. And it's very difficult to understand, seen in the light of the classical commentaries of the Chazal. This is what happened. It says that, now in Sefer Bereishis, we're reading the themes that come together, some of these dimensions come together in this way. It says that when Yaakov went down to Egypt, remember the story, he was separated from his son Joseph, Yosef. It says this. It says that after this long separation, when he was reunited with his son, one of the things that happened was that he was introduced to Paro, the king, Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And the Chazal record, the Midrashic writings, a very interesting interchange that happened between them. Paro took a look at Yaakov, and he said, "How old are you?" Natural question. He was a very old man. He was well over 100 at the time. I think he was 130 at the time. I'm not mistaken, 120, 130. He said to him, "How old are you?" So Yaakov said, he said an unusual answer. He said that, "Ma'at v'roi hayu yumei shnei chaya." That few and not so good have been the number of the days of my years. That's what he said. In other words, I haven't lived that long, and what I've lived has entailed suffering. That's what he said. What did he mean, suffering? Not difficult to understand. Yaakov had a life of intense suffering. His daughter was taken away from him, Dinah, raped by Shechem. His sons conducted themselves, Shimon and Levi, in response to that event in a way that he didn't approve of at all. He was hounded by Esav when he was younger. He had to flee for his life. For years he had to spend away from home, hounded by Esav. His nephew, let's call it Esav's grandson, tried to kill him, Eliphaz, was sent to kill him, and he escaped only with his life by giving away all that he possessed to him. He was separated from Joseph, from Yosef, in whom he saw a tremendous segment of the future of the Jewish people, turned his hopes on him in a certain way. He thought he died, he was separated, he mourned for him in the acute stage of mourning for 22 years, without knowing if he was alive. I mean, plenty of sufferings. It says that even when he tried to rest, says by Yeshev Yaakov, he tried to sit down and rest for a while, and that's when the troubles really began. But he didn't have any rest. He suffered badly. So Paro said to him, "How old are you?" He said that, "I've lived a modest amount of time, and it hasn't been so good." What happened because of that? So the Chazal say a remarkable thing. His life was shortened because he made that comment. Years were taken off his life. According to the calculation, he should have lived something, he should have lived as long as his father did, and he lived 33 years less. I'm not mistaken. 33 years were taken off of his life because he commented in that sort of negative fashion. Again, we're not judging Yaakov, I mean. We're talking about a man who was perfect by our standards, by any standards. But at his level of greatness, there was something wrong. Not at our level. We're not talking, not able to pass judgment on anybody in our state. But at his level of greatness, he did something less than what he should have done. I'm nervous, you see, because it says that dogs are one of the three places in the world that have prophecy left. So you might not know if what I'm saying is right, buddy. If he leaves, maybe you'll close it. So we have the following idea. Because he said this thing that was a little negative, or at least negative at his level, so his life was shortened. And the Chazal actually count up the words. the words that he used, the number of words used in that verse, those verses, the relevant psukim, those add up to 33 words. So because there were 33 words, as it were, of complaint, not that my years haven't been that good, so for each word used, the year of life was taken off. And he lived 33 years less than he should have, because he said something he shouldn't have. Of course he got judged at the level that he was capable of being judged. We're not judged that in that refined way, because we're not living at that pinnacle of perfection. But we still can learn the lesson relative to our own situation. What's even more remarkable, what bothers us even more about that, is if you examine the words and you count the words, you'll find it doesn't work out. If you count up the number of words that he used when he said that his life had been short and not that good, you find a remarkable thing. It's not 33 words, it's less than that. Where do they get the calculation of 33? You have to include the words used by Paroi. You follow? In other words, let's understand the scene. Yaakov arrives in front of Paroi, and Paroi looks at him and he sees an old man. So he says to him, how old are you? Okay? The question, Kama Yimei Shnei Fayecha, I think he said, how old are you? Those words that he uses, the question, are added in to the number of words that Yaakov answers, and the total comes to 33, and he's docked a year of life, taken off a year that he lives, 1 year for each word. Now the question, obvious question is, what's the fairness? He said something negative, if you can understand what that means, that it cost him a year of life. But the question? Somebody asks you a question? That's not my fault. He asked me a question. Paro said, how old are you? And for each word of the question, he suffers by losing a year of life? That's difficult. But to understand this idea, something about life and suffering and happiness, let's try and explore this, try and explore the background. Tonight we won't look from such a mystical perspective. Let's begin on a more level that's closer to the emotions. So he explains something like this. When you want to get an understanding of what this means, this tension between life and suffering, happiness, suffering, simcha, yisurin, suffering that a person experiences, the purpose of life in general, how it fits in, he explains the following thing. You have an idea, the following idea. It says that Paroi, the king of Egypt, again, it says that when he wished to deal with the Jews, he wished to come up with a plan to exterminate the Jews, it says he asked the question, he asked for advice from three of his advisors. Yisroi, Jethro, Yisroi, father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, Bilam, famous non-Jewish prophet, and Iyov, Job. The man who probably suffered more than anybody else who ever lived on earth. That discussion in the Chazal, whether he really lived or he didn't live, it's just a way to teach us something. But proverbial depth of suffering was what he experienced. So the problem is this. The problem that's difficult to explain is this. It says that he asked them advice what to do with the Jewish people. He asked each of them what to do. Should I treat them well? Should I try and exterminate them? How can we craftily try and bring about their destruction? And each of the three gave a different answer. Yisrael fled. Didn't say anything, ran away for us, escaped with his life. Iyov, the man who suffered intensely, answered nothing. Didn't answer anything. Sat there, sat on the fence as it were, didn't answer anything. And Bilam answered negatively. He said, wipe them out. What was the consequence? I mean, so you have three different kinds of response here. A negative response, that means destroy them. A non-response, that means he sat in the middle and said nothing, which could have been understood in either way. And a positive response in that he fled. Yisroi fled. He couldn't say treat them well because his life would have been forfeit. Obviously Paro didn't want to hear that. So instead of being able in order not to have to say that the opposite, he ran away. What was the fate of these three men? This is what's difficult to understand. The fate of them is this. Yisroi went on to achieve greatness, became the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. His daughter Zipporah married Moshe, became one of the greatest women who ever lived. He was richly rewarded in the long run. But the other two are what bother us. Bilam, who responded negatively, died an instant death. He said that the Jews don't deserve, right? Treat them badly, exterminate them. He was killed by the Jews later after the incident of the women whom he tried to seduce the Jewish people and bring about their destruction. That way, when the Jews met him in battle, he was killed by the sword instantaneously. Died an instant death. But Eoth, the man who didn't give an answer, the man who didn't say good or bad, suffered more intensely than any human being's ever been known to suffer. So the commentaries, Reb Chaim asks the following question. What's the justice in that? Well, which is worse? an instant painless death or a lifetime of the most intense suffering? So, I mean, the common wisdom, if you ask people in the street, you ask people of this generation, most people would probably choose instant death. Probably. Then a lifetime of agony. He lost everything, his children and his health and his wealth, and he suffered intense pain, unendurable pain. So the question is, what's the justice in that? Why was the man who said nothing, he sat in the middle, he didn't give an answer, why did he suffer such intense suffering? And the man who said bad, much worse than that, he said exterminate the Jews, he had a quick and painless death. So Reb Chaim explains the following principle, and it's this principle that we have to understand. Not easy to understand. That's why we have to work hard to understand. He says this: a life of the most intense suffering is vastly preferable to death. That's the message we have to get. In other words, the most intense suffering that a human being could ever experience for a lifetime is considered to be an ecstasy compared to not being alive. That means the work here, the work is this, that if a Jew experiences sufferings, he's still supposed to be in ecstasy because he's alive. Okay? That means, I mean, not saying it's easy to do, you have to at least understand the goal. The goal is that a person should have such an acute sense of simcha for the fact that he's alive, no matter how negative his life seems, no matter what ordeals he's going through. The fact that he's alive should be such a source of happiness that it should overshadow entirely even the most intense sufferings imaginable. That's a remarkable idea. A very, very hard level to attain. Try and understand this idea. The Baal HaMusa bring it out something like this. They explain as follows. First of all, where can we feel this connect with emotions? This idea in theory maybe makes sense, but where do you feel it? Where can you connect? Where do you feel the happiness of being alive? Where actually can you come in contact with the happiness of just being alive? Not that anything good happened to you, just being alive. How do you feel that? In other words, we tend to view life, the way we tend to see it is that life is neutral. That's what most people think. Being alive is life, that's neutral, that's sort of the midpoint. Now the question is, you're going to have a good day or a bad day? That's the way we think about it. Wake up in the morning, a person doesn't wake up in ecstasy. A person wakes up in the morning, they think to themselves, what's the first thought you have when you open your eyes? At best, neutral, right? At best. Sort of neutral, even keel. Now you look with trepidation to what the day is going to bring. Most people, by the way, don't wake up that way. Most people in this generation wake up hoping that halavai today just wouldn't be worse than yesterday. That's what we've got to right now, unfortunately. That's our, the best, the people with the best advantages in this generation look at life that way. Not a Jewish way of looking at things. But the Mefoshim say that's not the way. A person should wake up, the way a person should understand his life is that the neutral point is not being alive. Neutrality is what the universe has experienced for most of the time that you weren't around. Your life is just a flicker of existence, your human life, your life inside a body, in this level of existence. It's just a flicker of, an infinitesimal flicker of time, compared to the expanse of eternity. If you want to understand what neutrality really is, it's most of eternity when you aren't around. The fact that you're around here is a cause of incredible ecstasy. That should generate tremendous happiness. Person's not supposed to see that as neutral. Person's supposed to see that as way above neutral. But the question is, how much are you going to improve on that level that's way above neutral? Now, being alive isn't neutral at all. Where does this connect with emotions? So the Baal HaMusa, they explain something like this. If you want to get a chance to feel this, you should experience, for example, you picture to yourself one or two examples. One example they give is, imagine a person who's got a terrible illness, not chasushon, terminal illness, terrible. This person's got hours left to live, let's say. And he's looking towards the end, that the hours that are left to him, that's what he's got ahead of his, in front of his eyes. This person walks into his doctor's office, doctor's rooms, and the doctor examines him and he says, I can't believe it, you're cured. What does that person feel? What person walks home, he flies over the trees, leaps over the buildings. He walks up, what's he so happy about? Actually, think about it. What is this person so happy about? He's alive, that's all. What actually happened? What's he got that the next man doesn't have? On the contrary, he's probably got a bit less. He's probably pretty weak still. Been through quite a shaking experience. But this person's in ecstasy. Why? Of course, by the next morning, it's all over. By the next morning, the person isn't ecstatic at all. By the next morning, he's worrying, about how he's going to pay the medical bills that accumulated in the last, But the experience of being told that you're alive when you thought you were about not to be is an ecstatic experience. I once heard a mystic in Yerushalayim say that the worst experience he ever had, he didn't put it that way, he said the best experience he ever had was once when he was at the sea and he almost drowned. He was sucked under the waves. He was sucked under the waves and he couldn't breathe. And at the moment that he was about to die, that means as his consciousness began to slip away, he broke surface and he took a breath of air. And so that was the happiest moment of his life. The sensation of being alive, the sensation of just being alive, that was the happiest thing. In Kabbalah, in the mystical, we said we wouldn't get too heavy from a mystical point of view tonight, but just to understand one idea, the mystics say that the happiness of pleasure, the experience of pleasure, is just a connection with the fact that you're alive. All pleasure in the world, a fantastic mystical idea, all pleasure in the world is simply a connection to the fact that you're alive. Right? That's what pleasure is. What is a little sugar on your tongue? A little sugar on a person's tongue. What generates such happiness? When a few nerve endings are stimulated and a person feels happy. In Kabbalah, certain Kabbalistic sources, it says that the happiness that's generated by those experiences are that they shock you into an awareness that you're here. That's all. You just feel in a bigger way, in a larger than life way than you did, let's say larger, more intense than you did before, you feel that you're here. Beautiful proof for it is that they explain, the Beis Yosef actually explains this in the Shulchan Aruch, even halachic writings that comes out, it's that if you want a beautiful proof of this, you know that when you make a blessing, you know that there are two kinds of blessings that we make. We make a blessing on mitzvahs, not brikas on mitzvahs, and we also make what's called brikas hanenim. That means brachas that we make on pleasure. When you eat an apple, or you eat some food, you make a bracha on the pleasure of eating that food. Right? That's what it is. You don't make... The interesting thing is that you don't make a bracha on the sustenance that the food gives you. You make a bracha on the pleasure that the food gives you. That's why it's called brikas hanenim. It's not, you follow. You might think that when you take an apple, you make a blessing on the fact that the vitamins and the food value of the apple is going to sustain your body, but you don't. You make a blessing on the fact that it tastes good. Right? But the wording of the blessing is remarkable. When you make a bracha on the good taste of an apple, you say, L'hachayos b'ayim nefesh kol chai. That gives life to everything that lives. So Mefarshim pick this up and they say what it means is this, that when you mean, it's a beautiful, sensitive, subtle point, when you wish to make a blessing on the pleasure that you feel when you experience pleasure in the world, the words that you use are the fact that you're alive. Isn't that amazing? You follow? You don't say, blessed are you Hashem who gives me pleasure. You don't say that. You say, who makes me alive. That means I just become sensitive to the fact that I'm alive through pleasure. Right? Remarkable thing. In other words, what pleasure is just a switch that enables you to feel that you're alive, that's all. And when a person feels it most acutely is when he was about to lose it. When a person comes close to losing it, so that's when you feel you have it. And of course, the pathetic and crude version of this is the modern Western ethic of adventure. That's what people do. People who have no spiritual concept of life, so people dice with death in order to come close, yeah, to losing life, so that they then get a shot of adrenaline that makes them feel alive again. But that's the only reason that people who drive at 250 kilometers an hour around a concrete track, I'm not talking about people who do it for money, that, you know, even that, there's no other way to earn a living. I don't know, maybe you've got to ask a shala, I don't know. But people who do it for what's called adventure, which means just for the thrill of it, just for the sake of it, they're going to climb a mountain in the most difficult way possible. Right? Without getting paid for it. That is an experience that people are driven to, and as we pointed out before here, in Hebrew there's no word for that. In Torah there's no word. The English word adventure is untranslatable. There's no word for adventure. Because in the language of reality, that's an unreal concept. And you follow? People have a sense of being alive through understanding what life is. They don't... Who found Rav Shach jumping off towers with rubber ropes attached to his ankles to see... to see whether he's going to make it, you know, his head's going to hit the bottom or not. And it doesn't. People of spiritual greatness don't need to come close to losing it in order to appreciate it. A person understands what life is, feels the pleasure and the thrill and the reality of being alive without having to bring himself to the verge of losing it. And that's what one has to strive for. We'll try and come back in addition to this idea of pleasure. And if you look in the Musa works, you'll see, especially in more modern ones, you'll see that they write and they talk about the way a person should train himself in this ideal. The person shouldn't wake up in the morning and train himself to wake up, you know, with a hangover of the day before, of the weight on his shoulders, of what happened yesterday and what he expects to be worse today. A person should wake up in the morning and should, in fact, That's why the din is, the law is that when you wake up in the morning, you're going to leap out of bed. That's already hard enough for most of us. But it says clearly, like a lion, you have to leap, and you have to say modani. Modani means thank you, Hashem. I consciously acknowledge, before you even wash your hands, you consciously acknowledge the fact that you're alive, that's all. Just that you're alive. No matter if things are going well or things are not going well. That's a Jewish idea. The people who take it in detail, if you listen to Rabbi Victor Miller, people who talk about it in detail, if you're having trouble doing it, he helps you along. What do you have? So you wake up this morning. So things aren't so good. Things haven't been going so well this week, let's say. This year, this decade maybe for most of us. So what do you say to yourself? You say, Baruch Hashem, I've got 2 hours. 2 hours are intense happiness. Intense happiness. Now people feel it don't happen. Or 2 kidneys. You know what happiness 2 kidneys is? You know how ecstatic you can get over the fact that you possess a rectum? I can tell you as a doctor, unfortunately, I know lots of people who don't have a rectum. You might not think that's a source of ecstasy. But people who don't have it, they'd give anything to have that thing that you look on in not exactly a positive fashion. Now many things, many parts of your body, your physical existence, the things that you at best take for granted, that if you understood correctly what they mean, it's a tremendous source of happiness. There's a place in Eicha where it says, Ma yis'oinen odom chai. How can a person who's alive complain? You hear that? That's the Torah perspective. A person's alive, how can he complain? That's in Eicha. We're talking about the destruction. That means the epitome of the concept of destruction and pain and sadness in the world. But the fact that through it all you're still alive, and the Jewish people, individual, that's a source of tremendous, that should be a source of tremendous happiness. If you understand this, we can understand the question that we began with, and let's try and speak it out, and we can perhaps take it a little further. When Yaakov arrived in front of Paroi, so when Paroi looked at him and he said to him, how old are you? And Yaakov answered an answer that showed less than ecstasy about being alive. He complained, as it were, again, without any criticism here, but at his level of greatness. He complained, he said that my life has not been that long, and my life has not been that easy. That's what he said. So we see that he didn't value, this is a very painful message, this is a very painful message. That means at his level of spiritual sensitivity, at his level of greatness, he didn't express appreciation as he should have at his level for being alive. You don't appreciate it, it's taken away from you. That means you've given it to do a job of work. The first part of doing the job means to appreciate having the tools. He expressed the fact that his life hadn't been that happy, and he was talking about a man who suffered intensely. But because he expressed the idea that he suffered, instead of expressing a tranquil ecstasy, absolute being at peace with the world, he chose to express the fact that he suffered, and he must have had good reason to do it. So every word of complaint cost him a year of his life. And the fact that the fact that years were taken off for the question, unbelievable idea. Reb Chaim explains like this, the reason that years of life were taken off from him, because even the question that Paroi asked him, when Pharaoh said to him, how old are you? And for each word of the question he lost a year of life, it's because he looked old. You hear that? He looked old, so that Paroi was moved to ask, how old are you? And he shouldn't have looked old. You hear that? Had he lived correctly, had he lived at the level that was expected of a man of his level of greatness, he shouldn't have looked like he suffered at all. So the fact that he engendered the question, yeah, that his appearance generated the question, so he lost a year of life for the words of the question. You hear what's expected of us? Not only not to complain when you're going through intense suffering, and even be happy through it, which is the work of a Jew, but that you should look tranquil and you should look not as if it's not even affecting you. The focus that you should have on what it means to be here and to be given the opportunity to do what you're doing, the happiness of that should be so great that it couldn't even be seen on your face that you've suffered. I mean, at that level. At that level, each one in proportion to what he's capable of doing. It's a remarkable, it's a breathtaking idea. It shows you what's expected. What's expected of us. On the contrary, the Jewish attitude is that if you happen to be suffering, on the contrary, that's your job. That's your job of work. We know, the mystics say, that no one's given a load of suffering that they can't bear. No one's ever put into an ordeal that they can't handle. Most people going through ordeals feel that they can't handle the ordeal. They feel part of the ordeal is that it feels unbearable. If it was easy to cope with, it wouldn't be an ordeal. Part of the ordeal is that it's difficult to cope with. And as we pointed out on various other occasions, one of the most difficult aspects of the ordeal is that it doesn't make any sense either. Even if it was difficult, even if it were almost impossible to bear, but you knew it made sense. You knew that something good was going to come out of this. So you have the strength. The trouble is you don't know why it's happening. You don't understand why it's happening. You certainly don't understand why me. You don't think you've got the strength to bear it. In other words, the very tools that you need to cope with experience, those are the ones that are threatened by the experience. Nobody said it's easy. But we have a mystical axiom that no one's given a load to bear that they can't bear. So the Jewish attitude is exactly the opposite. It's to turn impossibility into the possible. It's to turn the very impossibility of the situation into happiness. That if this is what I've been given to bear, this is what I'm supposed to be doing here. And it could be that a person in intense suffering, could be that their job is to teach the spiritual message of what it means to be dignified in such a situation. Or to teach what it means to generate some kind of happiness that other people couldn't even believe that a person could reach happiness in such a situation. Each person has to know exactly what it is that they're supposed to be doing. But the one thing a person's not supposed to do is lose faith. A person should crash in emunah. And that's the last thing that a person should do. The depth of the experience, the worse the soil is, the more it threatens emunah. But that's exactly what a person's not supposed to do, is to hold strong in faith and know that it means something, even if I can't explain to you what it means right now. Let's try to take it a step further. What exactly is this happiness? What exactly is this simcha? And how does a person get it? It's all very well to say that being alive should generate the happiness. What if it doesn't? How do you switch it on? What exactly is the happiness of being alive? See, the people who talk about this, they on the contrary, they express the idea that if you think about it logically, there is no such thing as happiness. You read Koheles, for example. You see it expressed there in many different ways. What exactly should be the cause of happiness? How does this make sense? So being alive is a cause of happiness. Why? Because it's a special gift to be alive. Why exactly? One second. Why exactly is it a special gift? Why should I feel happy at being alive with all the suffering that's going on? On the contrary, if a person's really sensitive, how can you be happy? Even if you don't have personal sufferings. Even if there's a person, even if there's one family, it's hard to imagine these days, that there's a family that doesn't have some acute suffering somewhere. But even if you happen to be in such a fortunate situation, and by the way, we just stop for an aside here, should know, that people who don't have acute suffering are the ones who are really in trouble. Because it says in many places that a person who's bearing a load of suffering, so at least he's assured that Hashem's relating to him, that he's worth correcting, that he's worth being worked on. But it says in certain places that if a person goes 40 days in life, for 40 days with no suffering, he's in big trouble. If you're happy for 40 days, that's when you really should start worrying. Because it means you're not worth being corrected. When no one's paying any attention to you. Before Shem says, it's like a child in a house that they've so lost hope with. In such exasperation with the child, they don't punish him anymore. When the child can just do exactly as he pleases. That's the most awesome din when a person has no relationship anymore with him. So if a person, if it goes well, doesn't have to be major suffering. The Gemara says even putting your hand into your pocket and finding a coin isn't there that you thought it was. Even that could be suffering. I don't know how much problems in life that could counterbalance such a little thing. But nevertheless, but some suffering at least, and therefore a person who has no suffering is in big trouble, and a person who has no suffering has a lot of advantages in life that are doubly responsible to work. A person who has to teach, if somebody who's suffering has to bring a spiritual message to the world, and coping with their suffering is how they teach their message, so somebody who doesn't have any suffering in the world, that is doubly responsible. He has all the advantages, and nobody's loading him down. So such an individual has to bring a tremendous spiritual message into the world. A person has to use every fiber of his being and every ounce of energy to bring into the world the teaching that he has to bring in, to benefit the world the way he has to benefit it. When he's been given the advantages and the lack of suffering in order to do that. So a person who sits back, Vayeshev Yaakov, a person who sits back and doesn't use his good fortune in order to build at least as much as the next dwarf person who's suffering, you're much more responsible. Good. So let's understand, let's continue. So what exactly is the anatomy of this kind of happiness? Here you have a situation where a person, let's say even a person is not suffering, but how can you be insensitive to the people who are? You know so many people are suffering so intensely, even one person, even if you know one person who's suffering so intractable. So how can you genuinely be happy? You have to be very insensitive. Very insensitive. How can you generate happiness? It's a very difficult question. A person has a friend or an acquaintance or somebody who's going through agony. So it says, if there's Hashem simcha, so you have to walk out there and you have to start being happy. What kind of insensitivity is that? Huh? And everybody knows somebody who's in terrible suffering. So where do you generate this happiness? How does it make sense? What does it mean exactly? So we've discussed various aspects of this before. But one aspect that we haven't exactly, a dimension we haven't looked at, and let's spend a few minutes just trying to understand, is as follows. And here we will touch on the mystical sources. If you look in the sources that talk about this sort of thing, they express the idea that happiness comes from the dimension of transition from one dimension to another. I'm trying to understand that. Happiness is generated by the expansion of one reality into another. Happiness is not just being static. On the contrary, that's a tremendous sadness. There are even places where it says that the Hebrew word atzlut, right, atzlus, and atzvus, that means inactivity and depression, are very closely related. I mean, depression is a spiritual response to spiritual non-activity. On the contrary, remaining static is a source of sadness. Growth spiritually, it means transition from one form to another, or expansion from one form to another spiritually. That's the source of happiness. Let's try and understand it. It's a remarkable secret. If a person can understand this secret, a person can know where to look in the mess of sadness and agony that the world appears to be. A person can know where to extract happiness. It's a remarkable thing. Of course, you have to be sensitive about it. You do it appropriately. The Chazon Ish writes in one place that a person who understands the truth about the world can never be sad. That's what he says. That it's impossible to be sad if you understand the truth about the world. There's a Gemara, a remarkable thing. Want to learn it? We can learn this message from a Gemara that talks about halacha. There's a Gemara, I think it's in Erevin. The Gemara talks about a measurement called a tefach. Remarkable thing. There's a thing called a tefach. A tefach is a hand's breadth. It's that much. That's 9 or 10 centimeters according to different opinions. 8, 9, 10 centimeters. That's a tefach. But it's a remarkable thing. There's two kinds of tefach. There's two kinds. When you talk about a tefach, one hand's breadth, when the Gemara talks about measurements of things that have to be built, constructed to within, they have to have so many tefach. The tefach is the unit of measure. There's two kinds. There's one called the tefach atzuf, and one called the tefach sameach. Remarkable thing. There's a hand's breadth that's called a sad tefach, tefach atzuf, and there's a hand's breadth that's called tefach sameach, a happy tefach. You hear that? So seriously, that's the halachic name for it. What exactly is a sad hand's breadth? What exactly is a happy one? Remarkable idea. So Gemara says this. This kind of hand breadth, like that, that's called tefach atzuf, that's called sad. And this kind, where it's expanded, is called smiling. Tefach seichek. A smiling hand breadth, a happy one. Not samach, seichek. Smiling, happy. What does this mean? So they ask a question. If there's two different measures, give it two different names. Again, you follow? If there's a 10 centimeter hand breadth and then there's an 11 centimeter hand breadth, so call them two different names. One's a tefach and one's tefach plus something. You follow? Or give it a different name. This is called a tefach and this is called an amma, cubit. We don't call them two different kinds of the same thing. They're two different measures. They've got two different names. So the problem is, if you're going to give me that much and that much, so give me two different names. What are you talking? The same name, and one's called sad and one's called happy. Smiling. But the answer is this. What's being taught here, fantastic idea. The Gemara, the Torah teaches you in a hidden place in halacha. You would never think to understand it there. Is the idea that it's the very same thing that takes two forms. That's why it's happy. Happiness is not a different thing. Happiness is when the thing that looks shrunken and limited has an ability to expand to something else. That's what happiness is. That's exactly what happiness is. It's being able to extract out of a situation of sadness, or what looks like limitation, it's being able to extract out of that something greater. That's the only place that a person can achieve any happiness. We're not talking about the fools. What's called tzchek haksil, the laughter of the fool, which is the people who try and generate false laughter in the world by trying to make themselves laugh. That's not happy at all. That's a very sad sound. If you've ever seen anybody, if you've ever heard the sound of people laughing because they're trying to make themselves laugh, it's an awfully sad sound. They're terribly hollering. People who do things to make themselves happy when there's no cause for happiness, just an escape from the reality, that's not happy at all. While they're lost in that world, they think it's happy, but afterwards generates a tremendous depression. If you want to hear it in its extreme form, one of the saddest things you can ever hear is the hysterical laughter of a person who doesn't have his senses at all. You ever hear a person who's lost contact, right? Somebody who's disturbed mentally to the extent that he's not living within his mind anymore. If you hear that hysterical laughter, there's nothing sadder than that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about genuine happiness, which can never be expressed fully in this world. It says, that a Jew is not allowed to laugh with his mouth full of laughter. It says, Azimal eschektiv, then our mouths will be full of laughter. Only when the true reality is revealed. Right now you have to be modest about it. You can't laugh with full expression in this world. You can't reveal it. You can feel it happy. Yeah, you can feel it inside. On the contrary, it's a remarkable job that you have to do. You have to feel the happiness inwardly. It says, if there's Hashem b'simcha, it doesn't say halfway. It says you have to serve Hashem with happiness. It doesn't only mean you have to serve Hashem in happiness, it means you have to serve Hashem with happiness. It doesn't just mean serve Hashem and while you're doing it, be happy. It doesn't mean that. It means you have to generate happiness, and it's the happiness that serves you. It's the fact that you're able to be happy, to be b'simcha correctly. That's how you serve Hashem. It doesn't say to do that halfway. There's no place in halacha that it says a person should only be halfway happy. You're supposed to be completely happy, ecstatically happy, but you're just not allowed to show it completely on the outside. That's inappropriate. That's inappropriate because you're living in a world that doesn't show it on the outside. In a different kind of world that comes after this one, there'll be a way of showing it externally. But in this world, it can't be shown externally, only inwardly. But nevertheless, the person has to feel it inwardly. And the only way you can feel it inwardly and begin to express it in any way is when you take a situation of limitation and that situation begins to smile. The same tefach, the same measure of tzimtzum, the same measure that's limited, the same measure that couldn't be shrunken anymore, it's so shrunken. When that expands to a new thing, it's the same name, it's the same thing, but expanded to a new dimension, it's the only place that happiness lies in the world. The person wants to explore this again. If you want to try and connect it, if we want to connect it with emotions, where would you experience this? So you see, if you think about it carefully, you'll see that the experiences that generate genuine happiness in the world are always experiences where a person lifts himself beyond his present state. In other words, when a person makes a connection, transcends, and I understand this idea well, it's a remarkable mystical idea. When a person transcends from one state of being into a higher state, automatically the response is happiness. The person gets married, let's say. It's an expansion of consciousness into a new, now the person has now expanded into a relationship, into a version of his own being that now is much greater than one human being. Tremendous happiness. A person has a child. What's the happiness of having a child in the world? What exactly is the happiness? On the contrary, it's a responsibility. What's the happiness? The happiness is that there's now an expanded version of your own personality in the world. Your own spiritual being in the world now has expanded to a new dimension. A person experiences Shabbos correctly. Shabbos is an expanded version of reality. A person can achieve a consciousness on Shabbos. Right? A sense of tachlis, a sense of transcendence into a dimension completely above this one. A person does it properly. That generates happiness. These are the things in life that generate happiness. Even pleasure, as we said before, just simple physical pleasure, actually, is a way of realizing that life is tangible and can be used to be expanded. There's a remarkable insight into this. The mystics talk about it in the following way. I'm trying to understand this. The mystics say that if you see a person who's happy, if you see a man who's happy, right, with one of these expanded consciousness experiences, you see that there's a response that often takes place. He wishes to drink something. Isn't that remarkable? When a person feels that his neshama is lifted, he wants to drink wine. Or something that he helps the kli expand. The mystics say that when the neshama has an ability to apprehend a higher existence, so then a person has the desire to expand the vessel. And a person tries to do that, again you can do it wrongly. Again, of course, there are those who try to expand the vessel. Well, there's nothing much to talk about inside through alcohol. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a person who feels that there's an expansion of his consciousness and he wants to help the vessel expand to hold it. So the response is that he wishes to take a drink. So the mystics say that if you understand this, it's because the secret dimension, the dimension that's inward, the secret dimension, when that's given a chance to express itself on the outside, in other words, you have a shrunken reality that's trapped within a certain level. When that's allowed to come out into its expanded version, that's a tremendous revelation of happiness. The way it's put mystically is it says, Nichnas yayin yotza sod. That when wine goes in, the secret comes out. In other words, the secret dimension, the secret hidden dimension, is allowed to expand and reveal itself through the loosening of the vessel that you do when you take wine. Remarkable thing. You know, the word wine, yayin in Hebrew, adds up to 70. Which the mystics always say, the full expansion of reality. The verge, the borderline of what the physical world can reach to, is 70. And the word sod in Hebrew, which means the secret world, adds up to 70. So we understand that if you want to get in touch with that secret, you want to allow it to flow out and expand in the world, so wine is the agency that does that. Remarkable idea. Because wine is that, if you handle it wrongly, if you handle the physical experience wrongly, it overwhelms you and makes you even more physical. But if used correctly, that means a person can connect himself to the physical world in such a way that it just gives enough opportunity to the spiritual dimension to expand. So that's a tremendous expansion of consciousness. We've got a very fine line between the two. Not easy, a very fine line, but it can be done. And if you think about it, you'll see that every time that we transcend from one level to another, we take one. It's a remarkable aspect of the Jewish tradition. That every time we wish to expand from one dimension to another, we wish to change from one form to another form, we take one. Where do you see it? Bris Milah, for example. What is a bris? A bris is taking a child from one level and doing something to him in the physical dimension that enables him to transcend into a different spiritual world. We take one at that moment, which is the agency of transcendence. A marriage, we take one. Kiddush, when the Shabbos comes in, that's a transition from a weak level, which is a normal level, into a level that's transcendent, we take one at that moment. In other words, we take the very agency, we take an agency of physicality, something that in its own right can make a person even more physical, and we use that to transcend from one dimension to the next. The mystics even say that Havdalah, remarkable thing. This is the Jewish attitude to life. Havdalah is the distinction between Shabbos and the week. On the contrary, you're coming down. You hear the question? Why do you take one? Why do you take one when you're living at a dimension of expanded consciousness, Shabbos, and now you come down into the week? On the contrary, that's a time to stay away from one. The answer is this. A person who lives incorrectly, a person who grasps life incorrectly, grasps that when Shabbos leaves, he takes a dip, he drops. A person who lives correctly, there's a Gemara that deals with this. A person who lives correctly understands that after Shabbos, it's a click into a new spiral where the next Shabbos will be higher than the one before. A person doesn't go through the same up and the same down all his life. That's not called progress. A person understands that after Shabbos, there's a new week beginning that has an injection of energy that he got from the previous Shabbos, that he should be able to use the new week as a step, as a ladder to achieve a new level the next Shabbos that he never achieved before. On the contrary, tremendous step up. It's a step down in spiritual consciousness from Shabbos. But he's stepping down into a tool where he can apply, get his gears meshed again, and he can use it as a tremendous happiness, even more maybe than the other one. Not just that he's passively going to be riding in a spiritual world, but he's now going to get his teeth into the physical. The mystics say that if you want to understand this idea really in depth, you should hear me when I do get mystical. You don't mind, right? Mind is not supposed to be. If you want to understand the idea in depth, it says that it's understood from what Adam did. You know that there's one opinion in the Gemara that the sin of Adam Arishon, the fruit, you know, it's a debate. Most people think in a very crude and un-Jewish way that the fruit he ate was an apple. There's no opinion at all that he ate an apple. There are different opinions about what fruit he ate. But one opinion that the Gemara, we understand that these are all true. In these mystical ideas, we understand it's not an argument at all. They're all just bringing out a different facet of reality. The Gemara says that what he ate was a grapes, wine. The sin involved wine. You hear that? Remarkable thing. Why? Because he wished to cause transcendence. He wished to change the form of reality from one form to another. Very much like Havdalah. He wished to descend from the spiritual into the physical so that he could then himself elevate the physical. That's happiness. That's happiness. He wanted to use the power of wine, which is that connection to the world of happiness. He wanted to use the step down from the passive level of Shabbos that he was in. You follow? He wanted to step down from the level where it was all a gift. He wanted to step into the darkness of the physical world and use his own energy to bring it back to where it was before. He was wrong about it. He was wrong. He had a command not to do it. But the idea, where do you see it again? I'm sure you're racing ahead of me. Where do you see it again? You see it by Noach. Why did Noach plant a vine? Why did he drink? As soon as he came out of the ark, right? When the Tabor settled and Noach came out, what happened? He planted a vine and he drank and he became drunk. It went wrong, but what was the idea? In the mystical sources it says he wanted to correct the mistake that Adam had made. He wanted to drink wine correctly. He wanted to transcend. He was aware that he'd come through an experience where the world had transcended one form to the next. And he wished to correct the mistake. He was aware that he was at the beginning. He was again an Adam Arishon. Just as Adam had been placed in the world alone, and he had to cause it to become what it had to become, Noach felt that it was a second chance to do the same thing. That's what it says. And he wanted to bring, and he chose wine again. It went wrong again. But the idea was there. What do we see from all this? Let's bring it back to the practical level. We see that the secret of happiness in this world is not empty happiness, that a person has to be schizophrenic and switch off the sadness and just try to be happy. That's impossible. A person has to understand where in the sadness there's happiness. A person has to understand where Shabbos comes out of an experience that's not Shabbos. That's what a person has to understand. And before you say that Shabbos doesn't happen because of Shabbos, it happens because you worked all week. It says that you work 6 days, 6 days shall you work, it says, and then Shabbos. But it means that you only have Shabbos because you worked before it. That's where the transcendence happens. It's because a person can, the way a Jew relates to the world and extracts happiness from it, is that he understands the limitations of the world. He understands what it means to be geared into a world where there's a load that's to be borne, responsibility, might look like sadness. But he understands that the opportunity to be here, that's not neutral, the opportunity to be here, to be able to shoulder that load, to be able to extract out of such a situation, right, something useful, or to bring a teaching into the world that a person has to do through his own lifetime. Even a lifetime of suffering, maybe even specially through a lifetime of somebody who is undergoing tremendous suffering, and the person shows simply that he understands that this is for a purpose, let alone any other particular specific achievement. But a person lives through a life of sadness. Right? Even intense sadness, some people seem to have it all. Some people seem to go from one tragedy to another. They are living. What a person in that situation has to do, not to give up, that's exactly what they're not supposed to do. Now, the person's supposed to understand that it's through bearing this load specifically, and being able to teach something beautiful, through having this experience, that's the Jewish version of happiness. And that's how a person can genuinely feel happy. True that a person cannot laugh externally fully, because while the sadness is going on, it's a contradiction. There's no question about it. A person has to laugh modestly. Some occasions not laugh at all, express sadness. But inwardly, a person should never feel depression. Depression is never allowed. Sadness is appropriate at certain times. But depression, which means giving up, it's a sense of despair that's never allowed. A person has to generate an inner sense of happiness no matter how bad the situation. Again, no one's saying that this job is easy. But it's the goal to be set for a person who is given a load to bear where the natural response would be sadness. And that's the idea. When Yaakov Avinu comes in front of Pharaoh, he's held accountable, not just for saying something that's complaining, but for not radiating the happiness, for not radiating the happiness of what it means to be in this world. Even with sadness, to be teaching what he is, to be teaching what a Jew is. Yaakov Avinu is going through his sufferings because the sufferings are Torah. When a Jew, when Yaakov Avinu goes through the sufferings that he goes through, what happens to Dina is Torah. It's enshrined in Torah. That's a message, a spiritual message in the world. What his son, what Yosef goes through, the revelation that Yosef brings. What was the sadness of the Yosef experience? For 22 years separated from his father in agony, what does it bring to? When the brothers stand in front of him in agony, right? With the conviction that things can't get worse. When the brothers stand in front of him, and they're aware, the Sfas Emes says, that the end of the world has arrived. You remember the story, I'm not going to go over it. The brothers stand there, and the Sfas Emes says that the only two responses that there were in the world were one, to take Egypt apart, that means destroy the whole known world in order to get Benjamin out, or to go home humbly back to Canaan, back to Israel, and kill their father. When he saw that they'd come back without Benjamin, without Benjamin, he would die of grief on the spot. So what options did they have? Hashem had maneuvered them into a situation of the greatest crisis imaginable. That's the story of Jewish history. Not an accident or a one-time thing. That's the focus of Jewish history. Hashem, through the hidden hand of Yosef, that they didn't know was his brother, had maneuvered them into a situation. He only did it to get them to do tshuva. He only did it for their benefit in the long run, but they couldn't see that. Isn't that the exact image of suffering? They made a mistake. They sold their brother. And for 22 years it went from bad to worse. It got worse, and then there was a famine, and then they went down to Egypt, and some strange individual began torturing them. And he tortures them, and tortures them worse, and he lets them go back, and he keeps a brother, and finally makes them come down with Benjamin. Joseph makes them repeat the same mistake they made once before. He wants to get them maneuvered into the same situation, where he'll be able to say to them, you can all go, just leave your brother. He wants to challenge them. He wants to put them back in the same situation, where they once dropped a brother. They once let down a brother, son of Rachel. He wants to put them back in the same situation, this time get it right. Why is he squeezing them? Why is he squeezing them into this agony that they can't understand? For their correction. It's only for their good. When a parent punishes a child, the child doesn't enjoy it. The parent doesn't enjoy it either. But in the end, the child sees it's the only way to come right. And after 22 years of agony, of one thing going from bad to worse, and the worst of experiences, they couldn't understand it. They couldn't understand what was going on. When Yehuda stepped forward at the end, and he said to Yosef, I don't know what is going on. We know, but one thing we know, we deserve this. That's what the brother said. This is happening to us because of what we did to Joseph. They didn't know they were speaking to him. He couldn't control his tears when he heard that. But we know that we're going through this because we've got how it all works and what this means and why Hashem has done it in exactly this way and how this is going to end. We've no idea. They were convinced the world had ended. They thought they'd made a mistake that deserved the end of the world. And at that critical moment, they stood there in front of Yosef. And they said, they acknowledged that the only way, Yehuda turned to his brothers and he said, listen, the only way out of this is we'll have to destroy the place. You each take a city and wipe it out and I'll take three. They were ready to destroy the place, raise it to rubble, destroy the whole known world. Imagine the concept. They would have been murderers. That's what they would have had to come to. Or go back and watch their father die in agony, die of grief on the spot. At that moment, says this Rashi, Yehuda stepped forward and he said, look, how this all works, I don't know. That we deserve it, that's for sure. That it's just and it works out somehow, that's for sure. But what it means, I don't know. But one thing I know, take me. So he gave himself up to Hashem. Yehuda stepped forward and said, I promised my father. I promised him that I'd bring Binyamin back. Take me for a slave. You hear that? The king of Israel, Yehuda, is to be the king of the Jewish people. He steps forward and he says to Yosef, I promised. We have no option here. We either destroy the place, that's not an option. We go back and we watch Yaakov die, that's not an option. Take me. That means enslave the future of the Jewish people. Enslave the man who's to become, who was to have become, in his view, the king of the Jewish people, to lead the world to its perfection, to bring Torah to the world ultimately. Can you imagine a greater sense of failure? Can you imagine a sense of failure greater than that? For 22 years to have lived in the grief and agony of what they've done to their brother and the knowledge that they were responsible and finally it come to its culmination where they were all about to die and the only way out was to give himself up entirely. At that moment of crisis, when nothing could be worse, they hear the following two words. Ani Yosef. I'm Joseph. You know what they realize in that instant? They realize in one instant, imagine that, at the least likely moment in their lives, where there was no way to see redemption, the redemption came. And from where? From where? Source of the problem. The source of the torment, the source of the torment was the redemption. In that moment they realized that every second of agony that they'd lived through became a happiness. At that point in time they wouldn't have given up any of it. They realized that every moment that they'd gone through an ordeal was only for their perfection and they treasured it now. When the cup was found in Binyamin's sack. Right? And it was a moment of intense agony. And they were brought to the verge of not surviving that experience. Why did Joseph do that? He wanted to make them jealous of his brother, just like they'd once been jealous of him, and this time to get it right. And they did get it right. Think they'd give that up for anything? Although it was the most painful and difficult experience they could imagine at the time, that didn't make any sense. Now it became a treasure. In the Kabbalistic writings it says, when a woman gives birth, the pains afterwards become what she treasures. The pains at the time, imagine a person who didn't know what it was bringing about. It would look lethal, looks lethal, looks dangerous, painful, agonizing. But in the end, that's what brings life into the world. So you have to understand that when a person goes through suffering, they don't seem to make any sense. They seem worse than you can bear. They're protracted, they may be drawn out for years, they may be drawn out for a lifetime. And before they get better, they get worse. And when they're as bad as they can be and you think you couldn't hold them for a second, they get much worse. And when the only option staring in you in the face is complete obliteration, oblivion. There's no way out of the situation. That's when the Jew begins to taste the sweetness. Person is working on himself. Person who knows what life means. The goal that has to be in front of your eyes then is to draw that experience to happiness. Person doesn't give up at that moment. Person has to use that experience to know that this is all for a purpose. And a person has to think that. And that's the happiness. The revelation that what looked sad before is the cause, is the happiness. Not that the pain ends one day and then thank God it's over and now there's a happy time. That's not the pshat. The pshat is that a person has to realize that the pain they went through is happiness. It's the difficulty and the load that a person had to bear that specifically made them what they are. That is some of the difficult work of what it means to be a Jew and to try, at least have as an ideal and at least occasionally, to try and extract from a difficult situation some form of happiness.